Coming now to our survey of the emperor, to Caligula, or no, Caligula.
The picture was taken in this photograph.
A strong little drunk on the ride. This is based on a bust of him. And pretty close to what it looked like. Look at your second common wealth chronology. You see that Caligula, very shortly, 37 through 41, Tiberius was reigning in the days of the crucifixion of Jesus. And the crucifixion of Jesus was shortly before the death of Tiberius. So during Jesus' public ministry, it is Tiberius who is on the throne. And during Jesus' public ministry, these terrible purges were going on. This is what was going on in Rome, what we read last week.
Thought you were dead. Titus was ill fare, including what the order was smothered. So died Tiberius in the 78th year of his age. And anyway, the we read elsewhere that Caligula later on found out who was a witness to this smothering and had them all put to death. It could not be proved later on that he had killed, or he didn't, his favorite, his servant, Lampro, had killed some other Tiberius when he had the infantry to revive. Once a man is dead, he ought to stay dead. And all this foolishness about coming back to life and asking for bonuses. So, another. The one who was supposed to normally have taken the place of Tiberius was his son Germanicus. Now, Germanicus was not really his son, his adopted son. He was the son of his brother Drusus. He was a nephew, don't worry about that. But remember I said they would adopt him, you know, distant relatives and son. The one who was supposed to be early in Tiberius' time was this Germanicus, from whom, by the way, Germany is named. And, I'm sorry, that's not true. He was named after Germany. Germany was named, he was named Germanicus because he carried on many successful campaigns in Germany, north of Gaul or France. he was named, he got his name from Germany. And he was titled, carried the name Germanicus. And he was a very, very fine man. Germanicus was a great soldier. He was honorable. He was loved by the Roman people. They looked forward to the time when Germanicus would take over. In the latter days of Tiberius, when he was killing everybody in sight, for reasons I will not go into, but at the time, he did not want Germanicus to succeed him. His reasons were evil. You see, what he wanted Caligula, who was the son of Germanicus, to succeed him, for the primary reason, it seems, that Caligula was just as rotten as Tiberius was. It says, Caligula lived with his grandmother Antonia until Tiberius summoned him to Capri at the age of 19. He assumed his manly gown and shaved his first beard as soon as he arrived there. But this was their most informal occasion. The courtiers, that is the people hung around the emperor in court, tried every trick to force him into making complaints against Tiberius. Always tried without success. They didn't like him. And they were trying to get him to say something wrong so that Tiberius would throw him off the cliff too. He not only failed to show any interest in the murder of his relatives, at this time Tiberius was putting his relatives to death wholesale, yet but affected an amazing indifference to his own ill treatment. Behaving so obsequiously to his adopted grandfather and to the entire household that someone said to him very neatly, never was there a better slave or a worse master. But he just, anything Tiberius did was okay with him. You know? And they were very obsequious, that means he was. Then he was told, fawned upon him. And so, and even in those days, this is while he's still alive, while Tiberius is still alive, Caligula could not control his natural brutality. Now, by the way, Caligula, as you look at it, is the one, for instance, who is on the throne in the early days of the church, 37 through 41, about the time of when the church in Antioch is sending out Paul, by Caligula's on the throne. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I missed who? Germanicus?
Yeah, Germanicus was the adopted son of Tiberius, who was originally supposed to take over, be his successor to Tiberius, to the will. And the people loved him. Germanicus was a good man. Caligula was the son of Germanicus, a man.
True son?
Germanicus. Yeah, true son, yeah.
When
when Tiberius presented, so when he was in the halfway, these state of mind, is that when he took, that, you think that's when he adopted Germanicus? And when
later on, when he started going bad, then he changed his mind. Right, you got that. So now, this, I'm reading about the time. This is how Caligula got into his favor. Caligula was vowed for doing anything he said. It's real. Fawn upon Tiberius. There's a great slave who allowed the master.
Caligula?
Yeah. They said that about him later. He got to be emperor, I think, such a good slave of Tiberius. He made a good slave, but once he got to be emperor, he made a very bad master. That was what the saying was.
Was he a pervert like?
Yes. He says,
Tiberius killed
the medical. I'll tell you later. You could ask me a stupid question. Good answer. Talking about how Caligula got into the favor of Tiberius. Yet even in those days, Caligula could not control his natural brutality. He loved watching tortures and executions. And disguised in a wig and robe, abandoned himself madly to the pleasures of feasting and scandalous living. Tiberius was ready enough to indulge a passion which Caligula had for theatrical dancing and singing on the ground that it might have a civilizing influence on him. With characteristic shrewdness, the old emperor exactly gauged the young man's vicious inclinations and would often remark that Caligula's advent, that is, coming to Caligula to his throne, portended his own, coming to into the favor and coming to Capri where he would ascend to the throne, portended his own death and the ruin of everyone else. He said, "I am nursing a viper in Rome's bosom." And he once said, "I am educating a python who will mishandle," as a chariot driver, "will mishandle the fiery sun chariot and scorch the whole world." Good enough for him. That's what he was saying. In other words, Germanicus was too good. He wanted somebody. The old man was a cynic. See, you got to understand old Tiberius. He was a killer. He was a good soldier, but he was a sexual pervert. He was a bitter, cynical, hateful old man. And kind of, he was gone. He didn't care about anything else. And he held the Roman Empire in such disgust that he said, "I'll just give him hell." The final thumbing of his nose in the world. I keep coming back to this. You wonder the gospel is good news to these people. You get people like that at the top. You purposely try to ruin him. To ruin things. Okay. Well, anyway, the answer to your question is this, that did Tiberius have Germanicus killed? The answer is probably. Just before the death of Tiberius, Germanicus, read this. Well, anyway, Germanicus, who was very popular, he was on his way back to Rome from a military campaign, and he died unexpectedly. And the tradition is, the memory was, that he was poisoned by Tiberius. There arose a story about his death that when they cremated his body, and the Romans commonly practiced cremation, that his heart did not burn. This was significant because there was a commonly believed that when somebody was poisoned, the poison went to their heart, that's how they died, and it hardened the heart and would not burn. That's not true, but that was the story that was told. You know, the heart of Germanicus did not burn when he committed his body. Reflecting the general view, whether it's true or not, you can't be sure, but it was thought, we know that it was generally thought later that Germanicus' unexpected death was because of poison, which is very common, not uncommon at all, because Tiberius would hire an assassin, he would see that the
substance poisoning. By the way, the art of poisoning in the ancient world was a highly developed art. There were people who made a profession out of it, developing highly sophisticated poisons. And you wanted to get rid of somebody, that was a sure way to, because you never could be sure. Poisoning was so popular in the ancient world, they had the food tasters for the some people. Because obviously, without the modern knowledge of pathology, it's very impossible to tell somebody's been poisoned. And people dropped dead so quickly. People could, because in the ancient world, people get sick and die very quickly of things that we normally would not die from. But it's a common thing for people to get sick and die in 3 or 4 days with a high fever and die. And it was so common for people to die from food poisoning because of the inability, because of the lack of refrigeration and modern health standards. People died of botulism all the time. And it's very difficult to tell whether somebody died of natural food poisoning, whether somebody helped along with it. Because it was so inconclusive, it was a very popular way, and people were living through experts around food poisoning. So, it would not have been unusual at all for this to have happened. What happened, we don't know, but Germanicus did die. Well, the people of Rome were not aware of the true nature of Caligula at this time. Remember, when he went out at night, he would put a robe on. It was not his royal robe or his aristocratic robe. He would wear a wig to try to hide his debaucheries. So that when Caligula first came to the throne, he was very popular because he was the son of Germanicus. People had assumed or had great hopes that because he was the son of Germanicus, then he would be a good emperor. Another thing I want to mention going in, this is important to us, talking about the role of the New Testament, is that Caligula was a good friend of Herod Agrippa. And when we talk about the Herodian succession, we're going to come back and see, we're going to meet Caligula again. Okay? But Caligula is a good friend of Herod Agrippa. Let me mention it here, we'll touch on it again with Herod. But Herod was put in chains, in all the purges, Herod Agrippa was put in chains in Palestine. I believe it was in Jerusalem, maybe in Caesarea. But anyway, he was in chains because he was suspect. And he, while in prison and wearing this chain, he had already become a friend of Agrippa. Herod had a lot of money, was released from chains, but he had to stay in the prison, and he threw a feast for the prison officials, live it up, and then bring him away to the bottle, had a big time. When they heard that Tiberius was dead, they weren't sure exactly what to do, so they put him back in chains. When Caligula came to the throne, because he was a friend of Herod Agrippa, he gave him a gold chain to replace or commemorate the chain that he had worn in prison. It's famous in history. Herod Agrippa, without New Testament, he gave the Herod Agrippa, we hear the book of Acts. This Herod gave Caligula, I'm sorry, this Caligula gave Herod a gold chain to apologize to him for having worn chains. During the first 7 months of his reign, Caligula had a short reign, so we thought in terms of months, first few years, he was very popular. He came to the throne, the people, because he was Germanicus' son, they were very glad to see him. His name, Caligula, was really a nickname. His name is Caius Caesar, but I just got every third emperor was named Caius Caesar, so it's hard to tell by that. Therefore, to distinguish him, he has been called the name Caligula, and Caligula is Latin for what? Little boots. Because when he was with his father, Germanicus was a great military man, and Caligula, as a boy, was with his father on a military campaign, and he was, they made him a little suit of armor, not armor, but the breastplate, and they made him a little pair of military boots. The Romans wore a boot That is, it wasn't an open sandal, it was a closed-in sandal for the master. And it was laced up over the calf. Partly for protection, partly for warmth, partly to support the leg for the long marches. Kind of a good garment to wear. And they made him a little pair. Traveling around. And they call him Little Boots. That was the thing they didn't really know about. Mainly to distinguish him. He grew up in military camps. That's where he learned some of his things as a soldier. We were a hard bitten bunch. He learned some of the things that he practiced later on in his life. Caligula came to the throne, as I say, he was Caligula's succession seemed to the Roman people, one might almost say to the whole world, like a dream come true. The memory of Germanicus and compassion for a family had been practically wiped out by successive murders as the purges of Tiberius. Made most provincials and soldiers, many of whom had known him as a child, and the entire population of Rome as well, show extravagant joy that he was now emperor. Caligula strengthened his popularity by every possible means. He did every funeral speech in honor of Tiberius to the vast crowd, whooping profusely all the while. In the ancient world, they were trained what was called rhetoric. Gave him a magnificent burial. But as soon as this was over, he sailed for Pandateria and the Pontian Islands to fetch back the remains of his mother and his brother Nero, not the Nero that we know. And during rough weather, too in proof of devotion, he approached the ashes with the utmost readiness of Antalya. He brought the ashes of his cremated mother to Rome. He had two sisters. The names of Caligula's sisters were not included in the official oath which everyone had to take, which ran, and these sisters were undeceived. Caligula, to give you an idea of what kind of guy he was, he fell in love with his two sisters. So the names of Caligula's sisters were not included in the official oath which everyone had to take, which ran, I will not value, this is what a Roman soldier had to say, I will not value my life or that of my children less highly than I do the safety of the Emperor Gaius. But Gaius had an ad, and his sisters. Before they would say to him, I will not value the life of my life, the life of my wife and children, but the life of the Emperor Augustus. So, and he had an ad for his sisters. A similar bid for popularity was to recall all exiles, dismiss all criminal charges whatsoever their debt had been pending since the time of Tiberius. And many people were exiled or were innocent in purpose of Tiberius, and many were imprisoned in slavery because they were innocent. So he set them free, made them popular. He drove the Spintrian perverts from the city. Those were the people that Tiberius had trained in sexual perversion to satisfy his own lust, and Caligula got rid of them. Could with difficulty be restrained from drowning the lot. He couldn't drown the whole bunch. He gave for him anyway. So he had, this being the first 7 months, he was a pretty good emperor. Whether he actually was putting on a front or actually trying to be a good emperor, not generally agreed upon. But he kept him from having time to read, but he sort of did some reforms in the civil system. He tightened things up. Tiberius let things fall apart the last years of his reign when he put the decree and forgot about the empire. Caligula tried to pull things back together and did a pretty good job of it. Anyway, he began to put on vast spectacles, which were to become so important later to the church, as many Christians were a part of these spectacles that were put to death. But Suetonius writes, one of his spectacles was on such a fantastic scale that nothing like it had ever been seen before. He collected all available merchant ships and anchored them in two lines close together the whole way from Bahia to the mole at Petulia. I'm not sure what that is. Petulia, remember when Paul landed at Petulia, your Roman, in your Acts maps? Or was that Petulia on the way to Rome? Right here. And there's a bay across there. I'm not sure on this map. It's not quite here. You can't see it on the map, but there's a bay, a very deep bay there, which doesn't show up on this map. And so he it's a distance of 300 Roman miles, it says. I'm sorry, little one, three Roman miles, which is a little bit shorter than I'm in our mile. And so he had these ships. He had all these ships, anchored them in two lines close together the whole way across this bay. He's been on the island now. Then he had the ships boarded over with earth heaped on the planks and made kind of an Appian way along which he trotted back and forth on two consecutive days. Lined all these ships up, two lines, and laid boards across them and put dirt on top of the boards. On two successive days, he'd ride his horse back and forth just 3 miles across this bay, across the riding over on what we call pontoon bridge. Something similar. On the second, he appeared in charioteer's costume, driving a team of two famous horses with a boy named Darius, one of his Parthian hostages, triumphantly displaying the car beside him. Behind came the entire guard's division, a group of his friends mounted in Gallic curricles. That is the armor. Lincoln is, of course, juxtaposed to have built the bridge as an improvement on Xerxes' famous feat of bridging the much narrower Hellespont across here. Xerxes, back in the 5th century, when Xerxes was in Persia, back in Greece, which was out of Marathon. he's supposed to complete that. This is why he did it. And he said, why did you want to do that? A lot of time and money, trouble. Why bother? Well, he was trying to better the feat of Xerxes. Cleo, later on, he really thought of it in high value. He's one of the few emperors who really took seriously the idea of being a god. Tiberius, Augustus said, if you want to help, if you make the empire better to think I'm a god, go ahead. Tiberius couldn't care what that's one way or the other. But Caligula, after he went mad, actually believed it. And one time he built a thunder machine. I don't know why, I don't know what it was. It made a lot of noise and terrible. And they believed that when it thundered, this was Zeus culminating at the world. Well, when Zeus thundered, he'd thunder back. He'd just thunder or whatever, it was noise to show Zeus where to get off. But anyway, so somebody said, well, why did he do that crazy thing? Well, he did it to show that he was more powerful than Xerxes, who built a pontoon bridge over a much shorter distance, plus the Hellespont. Others believe that he planned this huge engineering feat to terrify the Germans and the Britons, on whom he had his eye. Now, my grandfather used to tell me, good historical source. My grandfather used to tell me, as a boy, Dad, according to some creeds, with King Caligula's confidence, the sole reason for the bridge was this. When Tiberius could not decide whom to appoint as his successor and inclined toward his grandsons and namesakes, Lucilius, the astrologer, had told him, this is when Tiberius trying to decide his new successor would be. Lucilius is supposed to have said, as for Gaius, he has no more chance of becoming emperor than of riding a horse dry shod across the Gulf of Baia. Now, whether that actually happened or not is pretty interesting. This may have been what's called an archaeological tale. A tale that was made up later to explain the event. But it may have been. Maybe in the early days in Tiberius trying to decide who might have said this. It got told around. Well, how about Gaius? Gaius. Oh, no. Caligula. He had not much chance of being emperor. He was riding a horse across the bay. But when he came emperor, he said, I'll show you. So he lined the ships up and rode a horse across the bay. Suetonius sort of said, here's a different story of why. He scared the Britons and the Germans, impressed them to better the feet of Xerxes, or to prove this also, prove the words of this astrologer. But nobody knows. But he did it. That's just something to see. He gave shows abroad. Then he goes on.
So much for Caligula the Emperor. The rest of this history must needs deal with Caligula the Monster. What happened was, after about 7 years in office, Caligula got sick. After 7 months, I'm sorry. Yeah, he's sick. For 7 months now, Caligula got sick. And historians suggest that something happened to his mind. He was already perverted and wild and cruel. But that which he was after his sickness was a whole new ballgame, even out in Tiberius. Caligula was probably, as far as these things go, the worst. You can imagine about being worse than Tiberius. But Caligula was. And from then on, he was the monster of Suetonius VI.
This interesting deal.
Now, again, this Caligula is on his ruling civil war during the missionary journey, during some of the missionary journeys of Paul, the early missionary journeys of Paul. And I think this is important, for when Paul appealed to Caesar, he appealed to Claudius, who was halfway Caesar. Probably never have done it, is in Caligula. So he goes on and tells about, he went back, and he began to really do crazy things. I'm excerpting now. One day he's overheard in the Capitoline Jupiter, that is the temple of Zeus, pressing his ear to the god's mouth. It was the chief god Zeus, or Jupiter, and the Romans called him. Whispering in the gods, pressing his ear to the god's mouth, you know, listening to him, sometimes raising his voice in anger. Once he was overheard threatening the god. If you do not raise me to heaven, I will cast you down to hell. Finally, he announced that Jupiter had persuaded him to share his home, and therefore connected the palace with the capital by throwing a bridge across the temple of God, of the god Augustus. After which he began building a new house inside the precinct of the capital itself. That is, he attached the temple of Zeus into his own house. It was his habit to commit incest with each of his three sisters, in turn, and at large banquets. When his wife reclined above him, that means, above him means lying to his back on this table arrangement and couches. With his wife looking on, it was his habit to commit incest with each of his three sisters, in turn, at these banquets. They say that he ravaged his sister Drusilla before he came of age. Their grandmother, this is Suetonius. Here's a bad piece of gossip. They say that he did this with a young man, which may have been true, may not have been true. It has been a rumor. Later he took Drusilla from her husband, that was another sister, the ex-consul Lucius Cassius Longinus, and quite unashamedly treating her as his wife. When he fell dangerously ill, left Drusilla all his property, the empire too. At her death, he made it a capital offense to laugh, to bathe, or to dine with one's parents, wives, or children while the period of public mourning lasted. So crazed with grief, this was his, over the death of his sister, who had become his lover. So crazy, and was so crazed with grief that he suddenly rushed from Rome by night, drove to the Campania, the military parade ground, took ship to Sicily, and returned just as impetuous without having shaved or cut his hair in the meantime. This is on the basis of this that historians say, well, he was fine, probably would have gone. Runs down, gets on board ship, goes to Sicily, turns around, comes back. It would be hard to say whether the way he got married, the way he dissolved his marriages, or the way he behaved as a husband was the most disgraceful. So it's real debate. Which was worse, the way he got married, the way he got unmarried, or the way he behaved while he was married? They're all so bad, you can't say which was worse. He attended the wedding ceremony of Gaius Piso and Livia Orestilla, but he had the bride carried off to his own home. Guess he didn't go invite any more weddings. After a few days, however, he sent her away. And 2 years later, banished her, suspecting she had returned to Piso in the interval. He probably did. According to one account, he told Piso, who was reclining opposite him at the wedding feast, "Hands off my wife." That is,
the story was told later on. Again, Sri Tonya's sister repeats the gospel. May have happened, may not have happened. And during the wedding feast, after Tito had married this girl, that Caligia said to him, "Keep your hands off my wife." And that's why he's saying, it's sort of strange the way he got his wife. It's a very interesting wedding ceremony. He goes to another man's wedding, and the other man married this woman, and he immediately considers the woman to be his wife and treats her as such. Well, anyway, let me read on. It seems, nor was he more respectful or considerate in his dealings with the Senate, that made some of the highest officials run for miles beside his chariot, dressed in their gown, or wait in short linen tunics at the head or foot of his dining couch. And that is, you see, Tiberius, remember, Tiberius came to the throne, he honored the Senate, consoled them about everything, even though he was going to do exactly all he wanted to do. Not Caligula. He didn't have sense enough to do that. He would get worse than Tiberius, I said. He would force the men, the old men, to run along in their dress gowns, whether it was not made for running, along beside his chariot for miles. Or if he was eating, in their short tunics, that means they were like a slave, to stand at the foot, you know, his couch, and he's eating, reclining at table, stand there like slaves. He would often send for a man whom he had secretly killed as though they were still alive, and remark offhandedly a few days later that they must have committed suicide. One of his quaestors, as a public official, was charged with conspiracy. Caligula had his clothes stripped off and spread on the ground to give the soldiers who flogged him a firmer foothold. He behaved just as arrogantly and violently towards people of less exalted rank. He used to like to go to the theater. And the theater, by the way, the seats were free in a theater. It was part of the government provided, you know, part of the games, the mall. Are we talking about the mall? Unemployed citizenry in Rome, so, well, when they would put on plays, you would have several thousand people, some over 100,000 people, some over 200,000 people at various times. They had nothing to do but go to these spectacles. You can imagine what would happen if every time a play was put on, there would be a mob scene. People trample, kill to get the seat. And Caligula had the emperor's box, you know, out away from all this. And so what he used to do to make it worse, he would put money on some of the seats, and then people would. He'd sit up and watch, and when they opened the doors, they would get more trampling. He'd say, "Yeah, go ahead." Kind of like, you know, what a preacher does in the pulpit when they open the doors. During gladiatorial shows, he would have the canopies removed at the hottest time of the day and forbid anyone to leave or cancel the regular program. You know, the citizens kind of get hot, you know, this is the nobility. And he would have the canopies removed and make him sit in the sun. And pit feeble old fighters against decrepit criminals. Or stage comic duels between respectable householders who happen to be physically disabled in some other way. Caligula had this thing, he hated anybody who was disfigured. He was crippled with a withered hand. And more than once, he closed down the granaries and let the people go hungry. Why?
Why not?
The following instances illustrate how his bloody-mindedness. Having collected wild animals for one of his shows, he found butcher's meat too expensive and decided to feed them criminals instead. He paid more attention to the charge sheet, that is, he didn't take into consideration what they were guilty of, you know, charged with. The simple stood in the middle of the colonnade, glanced at the prisoners lined up before him and gave the order, "Kill every man between the bald head and the other one over there." Arbitrator picked him out. Anyway, many men of decent family were branded at his command and sent down to the mines, or put to work on the road, or thrown to the wild beasts. Others were confined in narrow cages, where they had to crouch on all fours like animals, or were sawn in half. And not necessarily for major offenses, but merely for criticizing his shows, failing to swear by his genius. Listen, by his genius? That's what Polycarp is called upon to do, according to things that are trade, to swear by the genius of Caesar.
Caligula made parents attend their own son's execution. And one father excused himself on the ground of ill health. He couldn't. He was commanded to come and invited to come and watch his son being put to death. He said, I'm too sick. So he said, oh, no, I'll be kind. But it's in the litter for him. He wouldn't have to walk. The expense of the emperor. Having invited another father to dinner just after the son's execution, he overflowed with good fellowship in an attempt to make him laugh and joke. He watched the manager of his laboratorial mob these shows being flogged with chains for several days running, and had him killed only when the smell of the suffering brains became insupportable. And he had him beaten so carefully for a long period of time that he just wouldn't quite die, and his brains were literally coming out through the wound and finally clicked that I don't like that smell coming. Once Caligula asked a returned exile how he had been spending his time, flattering the man answered, I prayed continuously to the gods for Tiberius' death and your accession, and my prayer was granted. What did you do while you were exiled? Well, I spent all my time praying that you'd come to the throne. How could that make a guy mad? Caligula therefore concluded that the new batch of exiles must be praying for his own death, so he sent agents from island to island, had them all killed. Good logic, anyway. What did you do while you were in exile? I was praying for the death of Tiberius and you come to the throne. Everybody said he brought some back during the early months, the Tiberius in exile. So one, he met one of them one day and said, what did you do? What did you do while you were in exile? Oh, is that what exiles do while they're gone? You know? Well, then the ones who are in exile now must be praying for my death. So he sent and had them all killed. Being anxious that one particular senator should be torn in pieces, he persuaded some of his colleagues to challenge him as a public enemy. They entered the house, stabbing him with their pen and handing over for lynching to the rest of the Senate. Not satisfied with the victim's limbs, organs, and entrails had been dragged through the streets to keep up with his feet. Well, people hated him. He didn't care. Let them hate him so long as they fear me. He played a prank on Apelles, the tragic actor, by striking a pose beside the statue of Jupiter and asking, which of us two is the greater? You know, me or Jupiter. When Apelles hesitated momentarily, Caligula had his blog commenting on the musical quality of his groans for mercy. His actors were known for their beautiful voices. He said, oh, my pretty voice you have. He never kissed the neck of his wife or mistress without saying, and this beautiful throat will be cut in the back. Well, I'd love to kiss that old boy. Every time he kissed his wife or his mistress, he'd say, you know, don't you? Sometimes he even threatened to torture Caesonia as his wife as a means of discovering why she was so devoted to him. Well, anyway, he had not the slightest regard for chastity, either his own or others. He was accused of homosexuality that he used whoever he wanted to. He developed a passion for the feel of money, and spilling heaps of gold pieces in open space would walk over them barefoot or else lie down and wallow. When he played dice, he would always cheat and lie. And one day he... one of the reasons he had a complex about people who were not physically perfect. Neck thin, legs spindly, eyes sunken. His face only didn't like it. Eyes sunken, temples hollow, forehead broad and forbidding, scalp almost hairless. Later, I'll have to kiss a few necks, I guess. Anyway, one time he had his horse declared as a senator or a consul. He also had a temple built for the worship of his horse. One time he shoveled gold dust off the palace of one of the public buildings. He's a real rotten guy. He's actually perverted. He's insane, but look, that's really mad. Anyway, how did he die? On
January 24th, just past midday, Caligula, sitting in the theater, could not make up his mind whether to rise for the luncheon, take a noon break, and watch the show. He still felt a little uneasy after too heavy a bank on the previous night. He's sitting there, and he's out eating all night, so he said, you know what, he said, go out with lunch, or so I go out with lunch or not. However, his friends persuaded him to come out with them along a covered walk. There he found some boys of noble family whom he had summoned from Asia, rehearsing the Trojan War Dance. He stopped to watch and encourage them, and would have taken them back from the theater and held a performance at once, had their, these were actors who were outside the theater rehearsing. He liked what he saw. He was going to have them go on show. But one of them said, well, one of our troops is sick of a cold, so we're not going to perform today. Two different versions of what followed occur. Some say that Korea, who was a member of the Praetorian Guard, by the way, came up behind Caligula as he stood talking to the boys with a cry of, take this, gave him a deep sword wound in the neck, whereupon Gaius Sabinus, the other colonel, stabbed him in the breast. The other version makes Sabinus tell certain centurions, implicated in the plot, to clear away the crowd, then ask Caligula for the day's watchword. He is said to have yelled, Jupiter, whereupon Caria from his rear yelled, so be it. What he meant was, the idea was that when you became, if an emperor died, he became a god. And he declared himself Jupiter. What he believed was he would become Jupiter, and he would be apotheosis, or the process of becoming a god. And Jupiter said, okay, he'll be Jupiter. He stabbed him in the back, be Jupiter. So there's two versions, but regardless of which one you accept, members of the high officers, centurions of the Praetorian Guard, who were supposed to guard him, they assassinated him. Caligula lay twitching on the ground. I'm still alive, he shouted. But word went around. Strike again. And he succumbed to further wounds, including sword thrust to the genitals. It's like Caesona was murdered by a centurion, that was his wife, at the same time. And little Julia and Drusilla's brains were dashed out against the wall. In other words, they wanted not only to kill him, they wanted to kill his wife, who might have a son, who would be like it. See, the ancients had a belief. And by the way, it's not very ancient, that the bad character was passed on from the blood. You know, people with bad blood. And they were afraid that if his wife had another child, he would ascend to the throne and be just as bad as he was. And so they killed his wife and his daughter, lest his progeny come to haunt them in future years. Caligula's bearers rushed to him, using their litter poles as spears. As soon as German bodyguard appeared, too late to be of any service, so they killed several of the assassins and a few innocent senators in the bargain. Well, he died. It was an assassination plot. Nobody knows who paid for it, but maybe they did it on their own. Or maybe he insulted the wrong man. I don't know. But they, at least two of them, got together and killed him. And that was the end of Caligula, and everybody was glad. Yeah, hold on. There was a hand up, right? Go past the question. We'll continue our study of the emperors. Refer you again to the chronological the chronology that I gave you. Now, by the way, I'm covering this under Palestine. And that's not a very good place to put an outline. I don't know what's very good at the outline. So, you'll just have to worry about that. We come down to Claudius. Somebody read Acts 18, 1 and 2, please. Well, I got a good test for you. Acts 18, 1 and 2.
After these things, we left Athens and went toward them. We found a certain Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, had a priest from Italy, who was watched the facility, but Claudius would command all the Jews to leave Rome. He came there.
Okay. Here we have the mention, the famous mention of the expulsion of the Jews from Rome by Claudius, mentioned also by Tacitus, by the way. But without discussing that point, I simply want to say that we're now down to the emperor mentioned in the book of Acts, Claudius. The Caligula had a mercifully short reign. It was pointed out he was absolutely insane, and he was assassinated by the Praetorian Guard. Nobody sure exactly was behind him, why they were doing, but I was pretty happy when he was pushing up daisies. Now, Claudius, who reigned from 37 to 41, 41 through 54, a longer reign, of course, in Caligula, is the one that we have throughout the rest of the book of Acts. The one, the emperor who is ruling. Now, Claudius was a very interesting character. By the way, a brilliant novel by Robert Graves called I, Claudius has been available. It's a historical novel. I recommend it. Reading on the subject. I think I said this before, let me say it here, a little pressure. But I recommend for your, I think you ought to get in the habit of reading for relaxation instead of watching television. And I think you ought to relax some, by the way. I think there's one thing about it that's not said often enough to students. I think you ought to find everybody needs a break. And we found this near the church that we can have a we would often go for. You have a program that runs 2 or 3 nights a week for several weeks. You might as well give the people a break because they can take one anyway. They just won't show up. And we need breaks. And I recommend, since you're reading so much, I recommend reading for relaxation. Maybe sometime, maybe just a few minutes every time. I'm currently reading a book about that thing called Just a Mirror. The story of the historical survey of one character in a novel, which is history. One of the bestsellers, by the way, by Bartlett Tipman, a big scholar of medieval history in the 14th century. But anyway, it's an exceedingly thick book. And I would, and yet I'm already halfway through it. It's been reading for a couple of weeks, just by 15 minutes here and 10 minutes there. And I keep it at home if I find a few minutes, you know, and I'll relax, And it's amazing what you can get through in reading. A little bit here, a little bit there, but you read for relaxation. By that I mean, don't read something that you have to read. You have to be going to be tested on an assignment. And I recommend care. Read some what are called historical novels. Some of the writings of Taylor Caldwell. Taylor Caldwell's a woman, by the way. I don't think she's the greatest. She can't touch the end of the garment, say, of a missioner. But I recommend the like Mission of the Source. Taylor Caldwell, the Beloved Physician, her history things. It was drama's pretty good. And Lou Wallace and his books, Ben Hur, where you get into it's novels, it's set in a historical setting, and you learn a great deal. These fellows do research. And I recommend an edition, if I say, for a source, a textbook. And one of these that I recommend is what I'm talking about now, by Robert Graves, called I, Claudius. By the way, it was on television. On television sometime back on public TV. And very good. The point I'm making now is that Claudius is a very interesting character. He became a subject of this. There's an excellent writing by on the Herods by anyway, there's several of these and I recommend this. You learn a lot and it's a very fun way to learn. Well, anyway, this was on TV as well. Claudius is a very interesting character. He came to the throne. I'm going to read. I hope I'm not, rather than just going outlines, I'm taking time to read this because I have an ulterior motive. Have any of you been inspired to go to the library and read some of Suetonius for yourself? Or Tacitus?
Did it? Not that, but the Apocrypha is their thesis.
Well, you know what? You've got to read Herodotus. It's one of the greatest reading in the world. Read the primary sources. See, that's what I said to the scholars, somebody read the old books. And, intellectual, if you're an intellectual, I know you all are going to be intellectuals. I are. An intellectual is anybody who listens to the way you tell over you're not thinking about Ranger. You're going to be a real scholar. You have to, you ought to read the primary sources. You follow me? Primary sources. Anyway, I hope I create some interest in going back and reading the original. Claudius, here's Claudius. Claudius' mother often called him a monster. A man whom Mother Nature had begun to work on, then flung aside. If she ever accused anyone of stupidity, she would exclaim, "Why, he's a bigger fool even than my son Claudius." Livia Augusta's grandmother, he was related to, he was a grandnephew, I think, of Caesar Augustus. Livia Augusta's grandmother never failed to treat him with the deepest scorn and seldom addressed him personally. When his sister Lavella heard someone predict that he would one day succeed to the throne, she prayed aloud that the Roman people might be spared so cruel and undeserved a misfortune. Finally, to show what his great uncle Augustus thought of him, Suetonius, quote the following extract from the imperial correspondence. "My dear Livia, you suggest that I have not discussed with Tiberius what we should do about your grandson Claudius at the coming festival of Mars the Avenger. We both agree that an immediate decision ought to be taken. The question is whether he has, shall I say, full command of his five senses. So I can see nothing against him, against sending him through the same degrees of office as his brother," as his ceremonial giving of rank. "But should he prove physically and mentally deficient, the public, which is always amused by trifles, must not be given a chance at laughing at him and us." See, this doing this. In other words, how are we going to keep this old boy from disgracing the family at these public ceremonies? "I fear that we shall find ourselves in constant trouble if the question of his fitness to officiate in this or that capacity keeps cropping up. We should therefore decide in advance whether he can or cannot be trusted with office in the state generally." Mr. Augustus writing his mother saying, "You're the village idiot here, and what are you going to do with him? He's going to embarrass us." And so he goes on. So you think, wow, what a clown, if his own mother thinks that he's a monster who's not going to ruin with one oar. But it's interesting that Claudius was a very good emperor, as emperors go. Of course, emperors weren't going so hot in those days. But Claudius was the greatest, was the most scholarly of all the emperors, by the way. And what we're saying is we're going to see that when he got to the throne, he surprised everybody, perhaps even himself. He wasn't that bad. He was one of these guys who looked worse than he really was. Suetonius writes about Claudius. "Claudius also studied Greek with great application and took every opportunity of professing his love in his language, which he declared to be the finest of all." You might say, in other words, that to the Romans, Father, you were really, didn't really arrive, but you could speak Greek. "Once when a barbarian addressed him first in Latin, then in Greek, he replied, 'Since you come armed with both languages, with both our languages,'" 34, consider Greek to be our language, almost the first language. Well, anyway, he was a fine scholar, most scholarly of all the emperors. Herod Agrippa the First was instrumental in getting Claudius to accept the throne. Remember, Agrippa was a friend of Caligula's? Well, Caligula was done in. Agrippa encouraged Claudius. And when he came to the throne, he was the most reluctant emperor you could possibly imagine. When he heard that Augustus, that Caligula was dead, he was afraid they were going to make him emperor. And so he went and hid. Suetonius writes, "Having spent the better part of his life in circumstances like these, Claudius became emperor at the age of 50 by an extraordinary accident. When the assassins ordered Caligula's courtiers to disperse, pretending that he wished to be alone, Claudius went off with the rest and retired to a room called the Hermaeum, but presently heard about the murder and slipped away in alarm to a nearby balcony." And he was afraid of two things: they were going to make him emperor,
or they were going to kill him. If they were going to make him emperor, the way things work in those days, if they were going to make him emperor, if they would, he didn't want to be. Second, if they weren't going to make him emperor, they'd probably kill him because he was the pretender to the throne. That is, he was in line. So he slipped away and he hid trembling behind the door curtains. The guardsman, wandering vaguely through the palace, noticed a pair of feet beneath the curtain. Pulled their order out for identification.
And who are you looking there and jerking out?
And recognized him. Claudius dropped on the floor and clasped the soldier's knees, but found himself acclaimed emperor. He was on his knees before the soldier, praying for his life. And he said,
and the soldier said, "Hail, emperor."
He was emperor. There was hiding behind the curtain, his feet sticking out. Emperor of Rome didn't know it. So they took him to the palace guardhouse, and things were in a confusion. He spent the night among the sentries, guarding. And so finally, what happened was the Praetorian Guard Claudius found that either he was going to have to be emperor, or he was going to have to. Or his life was in danger. So he wanted, and the Praetorian Guard had assassinated Caligula. So he realized, in a state of anarchy, we've talked about before, a state of anarchy, the only source of order sometimes is the military. In this case, the Praetorian Guard. So he bribed the Praetorian Guard. It's not normally said to make him emperor. Well, they were already going to make him emperor, but he bribed the Praetorian Guard to sort of get them on his side. And it set a very evil precedent because the Praetorian Guard saw themselves from that point on as the ones who decided who would be emperor of Rome. And later on, we're going to see that they bought and sold the office with the Lachidae. That is, they left themselves open for bribes and were bribed. And then from that point on, they were generally bribed by the one who became emperor. Sort of like a protection racket or blackmail almost. I'll say that because in this case, it was very unsettled time. He promised every man 150 gold pieces, which made him the first of the Caesars to purchase the loyalty of his troops, not the last. Okay, any questions? He canceled some of the insane policies of Caligula. He was a pretty good emperor. Surprised everyone, as I said. Interesting, he restored Achaia and Macedonia to the Senate. And this is important because once he Achaia, Greece, the point is, once he restored Achaia to the Senate, then Achaia was ruled by a governor. That was the system we talked about. And so, right here, this southern area. So he restored it to the Senate. Which what should have been anyway, because it was not the name, there was no problem of revolt there. Nothing to mean supervision of the emperor. And so, this is important New Testament studies because we know that if Luke is historically accurate when he pictures Gallio, when Paul is brought, when he's at Corinth, he's brought on trial before Gallio, one Gallio, and he's given the right title. He's a governor, which is what he would have been, that would have been his title, if Achaia were a senatorial province, and we know from the other sources that it was. It's one of the reasons, by the way, it's a minor detail, it's one of the reasons why such scholars as Ramsey refuted the notion that Luke was historically inaccurate. He said, well, this is a minor detail, yet this is something that's so hard to be right about and so easy to be wrong about, that Luke is exactly accurate. You got that? Claudius, this little minor detail, one of the things that persuaded Ramsay to set himself against the Tubingen school, who said that Luke was historically unthinkable, that Acts was, that Luke was not accurate. He said, perfectly accurate. That these men had the exact, precise technical title they would have. That's a sidelight, but I think that's very important to New Testament studies. He refused to be called the emperor. He played down his deity. The empire, by and large, prospered under Claudius. He added Britain to the empire. He suppressed the Druids, the priestly class of Britain who practiced human sacrifice.
And so, by and large, although he was not, in other words, as emperors go, he was not all that bad. Personally, he was much like the rest, as far as his personal morals, his cruelty, and so forth. But he was a good administrator. And Rome needed that. Tiberius had let things fall apart during his last years. He went to Capri and the sexual perversions and forgot about administering the empire. Caligula was crazier than a March hare, and so not very much got done. And so, even though nobody expected anything good to come out of it, Claudius was a good administrator and helped things move along. Here's an example. Finding that a number of sick or worn out slaves had been marooned by their owners on the island of Aesculapius, as Asclepius is normally called, Asclepius was the god who was in charge of getting well, the god of doctors. And there's been found an inscription on this island, in the Tiber, south from Rome. But anyway, what these owners were doing is they get a sick slave, they couldn't get more money out of him, bring more work out of him. We talked about this before, talking about slavery. So what they would do, they would make them more to the stable. What they were doing in this case is, they were saying, so this slave was all used up or got sick, and so they, rather than feed them, they would very piously take them out and dump them on this island, saying, we're going to give them to God when they're sick. We'll give them to the God as Claudius when they get them well. And they were dying out there. Well, Claudius heard about this, and so he freed them all. And rule that none who got well again should return to the control of his former owners. What they did, they put them out there. They got well, they go get them and put them back to work. They just have to survive. He said, you can't do this. You know, if you do that, they're free. If they get well, they can't come back and reclaim them. Furthermore, that any owner who made away with the sick slave for the same mean reason should be charged with murder. It's pretty moral, isn't it? You know, if you do this to a slave and you put him out to let him die, or he's sick and you just suffocate him or throw him in the river, murder. Now here you find the influence of Stoicism. A slave is a person. You don't free him arbitrarily, but he is a person. One of his edicts banned travel through any Italian town except on foot, in a sedan chair, or in a litter. This is because the wealthy would storm through the streets in their chariots and their wagons, and run over children. And so he didn't like that. So, you know, he's real, very narrow streets. He said, what he's saying is, he allowed only people, or they could ride through on the horses, you know, and trample people. And so he said, he made a rule that you couldn't go through, except that there would be a lot of foot traffic. Well, you see, that's not all bad, is it? See, that's not what you expect from a man. His mother called him a monster. And when she said monster, he probably had some physical disabilities or physical, maybe had some nervous habits or something. And this is very suspicious of those people. He also stationed fire brigades at Puteoli and Ostia. Puteoli were fall landed, but on his way to Rome in prison. Ostia were fall was beheaded and buried. Ostia is on the very mouth, is the mouth of the Tiber River down on the coast, the seacoast town of Rome. But here, in other words, Augustus had put fire brigades in Rome, and here Claudius extends it and puts his other important Roman cities. It became illegal for foreigners to adopt the names of Roman families. And any who usurped the rights of Roman citizens were executed on the slopes of the Esquiline Hill. Well, anyway, so you get the picture. As far as the administrator, Claudius had surprised everybody, even historians. One of these things where Claudius was probably a scholarly little fella who did not impress anybody, was on the Charlton Heston type, but he may have had some, anyway, didn't seem to have all his senses, and yet they made him emperor. A good job. Now, Claudius is known, well, he wasn't, let me balance this out. Claudius had a certain dignity of presence which showed him the best advantage when he happened to be standing or seated and expressing no emotion. And he was more attractive sitting still than he was not sitting still. This was because, though tall, he wasn't small, well-built, handsome, with a fine head of white hair and a firm neck, he stumbled as he walked owing to the weakness of his knees.
because of either excited by play or serious business, he had several disagreeable traits. These include an uncontrollable laugh.
Maybe a Bible college student.
A horrible habit, under the stress of anger, of slobbering at the mouth, running at the nose. A stammer and a persistent nervous tic, which grew so bad under emotional stress that his head would toss from side to side. His health was wretched until he succeeded to the throne, and suddenly became excellent. Except for violent stomach ache, which often he said made him think of suicide.
Health improvement, did you hear me?
No matter, I'm excerpt skipping around. No matter where parties happened to be, he always felt ready for food or drink. One day while he loved to eat.
Yeah.
I thought you meant to go to Bible college, didn't you? One day while he was judging a case in Augustus' forum, this would be important. Remember Paul appealed to Caesar, or somebody would appeal to Caesar? In this case, it was Claudius. Later, Paul was going to appeal. Anyway, he was hearing this case, and the delicious smell of cooking assailed his nostrils. He descended from the tribunal, closed the court, and declared a recess, went to the dining room with a leaping priest, these were the charismatic, and they were, by the way, going to ecstasy and roll and spirits of the gods. Where he immediately took his place at the meal he had sent
it. This leaping priest and the temple of Mars had a big feast going, so he just went to the post court and invited himself to sit down for board when we eat. Where he immediately took his place at the meal he had sent it.
It was seldom that Claudius left the dining hall except gorged or sodden. That means drunk. He would then go to bed and sleep supine with his mouth wide open, thus allowing a feather to be put down his throat, which would bring up the superfluous food and drink and vomit. Then he goes to the expression that he uses feathers when he's very good at vomiting. Romans want you to eat like they like to vomit. So they eat again. They had a regular room for it, by the way. They would eat for orange, you know, for hours, and then go and feather and vomit. Come back and go out again. Feel an education, that's for you. He slept in short snatches, being usually awake before midnight. But let him begin to nod in court. He couldn't sleep at night. But let him begin to nod in court, and the lawyers had difficulty in rousing him, however loud they shouted. If you couldn't find him, he's hearing cases, he'd sleep like a baby. But at night he couldn't sleep. And of course he couldn't go poke the emperor and say, hey, wake up. They could hear these lawyers trying to make him heard and raise their voice, almost shout, the emperor is sleeping away. The poor guys were pleading their case at the top of their voice to no avail. His feelings for women were extremely passionate, but boys and men left him cold. Suetonius noticed this because, you know, at least he was passionate toward women, but at least he was not homosexual or bisexual, which was made him better at that point than some of the emperors of this century. So fervent was his devotion to dice that he published a book on the subject and used to play while out driving on a special board fitted to his carriage, which kept the dice from rolling off capriciously. So this was the oldest established permanent floating crap game in Rome.
Yeah.
I thought Rome didn't tolerate
something. Not in the religion of the Republic. And it's against Roman morals, but later on, Tiberius was homosexual or bisexual. it was a great shame. Of course, it was standard. Not for the Greeks now, but for the Romans.
Because it didn't become popular then, you
know, the emperor. No, it was also down by the common people now, but more of the aristocracy got into it. One of the reasons why we fell from the thing.
Is that what the term went wrong to the Romans too?
Thanks for asking. Now we come to this is one of the most ironic, if not humorous, events in ancient history, is the famous death of Claudius. Claudius had been married in a court marriage to the famous, notorious Messalina.
I'll just put on board about 10 minutes.
Oh,
Sunday, and I'm not responsible. I grabbed it down on college campus for the free time. M-E-S-S-A-L-I-N-A, Messalina, Amos. M-E-S-S-A-L-I-N-A. And S is made like this. M-E-S-S-A-L-I-N-A. And Messalina was a mess. She was one of the most notoriously wicked women of ancient history. Suetonius writes, Messalina, daughter of the cousin Messala Barbatus, it turned out that she was not only found, was not only guilty of other disgraceful crimes, but had gone so far as to commit bigamy with Gaius Silius, and even signed a formal marriage contract before witnesses. So Claudius executed her and told the guards of the vision that having been unfortunate in his wives, he was resolved to live a celibate life in the future. They could kill him if he did not keep his word. This works about taking the pledge. His wife, we'll read more about Tacitus. That's all he says about it. So Tacitus tells more about it. But what he did was he had her executed and took an oath before the Praetorian Guard, I'll never marry again, and you may kill me if I do. Of course, shortly after he married again, but they didn't kill him, but they were very good kill him. Or any old man thing concerning a woman is up in the past. Anyway, Messalina, Tacitus writes, had now grown weary of the very facility of her adulteries. That is, any man she wanted, any man came down the pike, she jumped in bed with, and finally she got tired of it. And so she was rushing into strange excesses, and perverted sex. When even Silius, either through some fatal infatuation or because he imagined that amid the danger which hung over him, danger itself was the best safety, urged the breaking off of all concealment. This was one of her secret lovers, and he said, well, just bring it out in the open. But he was in danger anyway. He thought maybe openness would suggest hope. They were not, he said, in such extremity as to have to wait for the emperor's old age to die. Harmless measures were for the innocent. Crime, once exposed, had no refuge but in audacity. They had accomplices in all who feared the same fate. For himself, anyway, so to make a long story short, she up and marries him while she's still married to the emperor.
Who is this?
This is Messalina.
I mean, who's she married?
Silius, S-I-L-I-U-S. Don't worry about that. I won't ask you about that. But to give you an idea of the kind of woman she was, she not only was sleeping all over town, and everybody knew it, she even married this one fellow, and she was already married. She was this kind of woman. Reread in another place. Messalina, meanwhile, more wildly profligate than ever, was celebrating in mid-autumn a representation of the vintage in her new home at the wine festival, at the Bacchanalia, the wine festival. The presses were being trodden, the vats were overflowing, women girdled skins were dancing as Bacchanals dance in their worship of their frenzy. Messalina, crowned with ivy and wearing the buskin, and who else, moved his head to some lascivious chorus. The buskin was like a mask, a helmet-type mask. It is said that one Matthias Valens climbed a very lofty tree in sport, and when they asked him what he saw, he replied, a terrible storm from Ostia. Possibly some such appearance had begun, perhaps a word dropped by chance became a prophecy. There was trouble coming for her. It did. Well, anyway, the last one, Messalina. So the emperor finally, he was not exactly the most moral character in the world, but he couldn't take this, and so he condemned her to death. And so Messalina, meanwhile, in the gardens of Lucullus, was struggling for life and writing letters of entreaty. That is, she was writing letters to all her aristocratic family, trying to work it out to save her own life. As she alternated between hope and fury, hope of trying to get out of it and being executed, fury of being so mistreated. In her extremity, it was her pride alone which forsook her. And he goes on, talks about, finally, life, she said, was over. She was not going to wait for the executioner. All that could be looked for was honor and death. But in that heart, utterly corrupted by profligacy, nothing noble remained. She still prolonged her tears. In other words, passive says she didn't have enough courage to take her own life. And by the way, that's the way it normally worked. They, kind of like Hitler. Hitler did this, by the way. They would find some royal personage, you know, an aristocrat, a nobleman, a guilty of a capital crime, they would allow time, unspoken law. She gives time to do themselves in before you take them to the executioner. So she was allowed this time. So Tacitus is saying, well, she didn't have enough pride to do herself in. She had the chance, yet she couldn't do it. She still prolonged her tears and idle complaints till the gates were forced open by the rush of the newcomers. And there stood at her side the tribune, sternly silent, and the freedmen, overwhelming her with copious insults of a servile tongue, that is, came to get her. Then for the first time, she understood her fate, and it finally dawned on her she wasn't going to get out of it. She put her hand to a dagger. In her terror, she was applying it ineffectually to her throat and breast. She was trying to stab herself and did a lousy job of it. When a blow from the tribune drove it through her, he helped her out. Her body was given up to her mother. Claudius was still at the banquet. Would he like to eat? Go over to find Claudius. There he is. When they told him that Messalina was dead, without mentioning whether it was by her own or another's hand, did she have enough courage to do the proper thing? Nor did he ask the question, but called for the cup and finished his repast as usual. Messalina's dead, he said, pass the wine. During the day which followed, he showed no sign of hatred or joy or anger or sadness. Stoic. Or, in a word, of any human emotion, either when he looked at her triumphant accusers or on her weeping children. The Senate assisted his forgetfulness by decreeing that her name and her statues should be removed from all places, public or private. So anyway, that was the end of the famous Messalina. Well, he should have stuck to his oath. May you strike me dead if I ever touch another woman, or if I ever marry one. So he, Lee Marvin is going to take now. Anyway, he's of course being sued under a common law situation. Anyway, he married somebody worse. And Claudius was pretty good administration. He was a lousy picker of women. He just couldn't do any sense at all when he was picking a wife. And he married the famous Agrippina, A-G-R-I-P-P-I-N-A, Agrippina, who was the mother of Nero. He married the famous Agrippina, who was the mother of Nero. A-G-G. I'm sorry, A-G. One G, I think. One G. A-G-R-I-P-P-I-N-A. Now, what did she do? Well, by the way, her first husband had been a man called Ahenobarbus, don't worry about it, called a red-haired, a very cruel man, and the father of Nero. One time, for instance, he purposely ran over a child with his chariot just to see the child die. And he was not exactly the noble Roman at all. I don't have time to go into this. What did Agrippina do? Well, Agrippina, what she did was, when she got to be queen, she had Claudius adopt Nero, her son, so that he could be the next emperor. First step number one, she had him adopt Nero as her son, as his son, who was her son, so that he could be the next emperor, and then she poisoned Claudius and he died. I've already talked about poisoning, how common it was, and why it was secret, so difficult to prove. Soon afterwards, he composed his will and made all the city magistrates put their seals as witness, that is, to make Nero his heir. But Agrippina, being now accused of many crimes by informers, she was just as bad as Messalina had been. Well, let me pick up right here. This last year, Claudius made it pretty plain that he repented of having married Agrippina and adopted Nero. For example, his freedmen congratulated him on having found a certain woman guilty of adultery. This one was a court trial. He remarked that he himself seemed fitted to marry wives who, quote, were unchaste but remain unchastened. And presently, meeting Britannicus, embraced him with a deep affection. Grow up quickly, my son, then I will explain what my policy has been. And this was over at the time of that.
Soon afterwards, he composed his will. I mean, all the city magistrates put their seals to his will. But Agrippina, being now accused of many crimes by informers, as well as her own conscience, prevented him from doing anything further on Britannicus' behalf. But as he, Britannicus was another Churchill relative, and what he wanted to do, he wanted to disinherit. He was just about to change his mind, to disinherit Nero, and put Britannicus. Britannicus was very young, and so this is why Agrippina went ahead and poisoned him before he could change his will. That's how Nero got to the throne, by the way. Most people think that Claudius was poisoned, but when and by whom is disputed. Some say that the eunuch Helotus, his official taster, administered the drug while he was dining with the priests of Jupiter in the citadel. Others that Agrippina did so herself at a family banquet, poisoning a dish of mushrooms, his favorite food. And according to many, an equal discrepancy exists between the accounts of what happened next. According to many of my informants, he lost his power of speech, suffered frightful pain all night long, and died shortly before dawn. Difficult death by poisoning. A variant version is that he fell into a coma, but vomited up the entire contents of his stomach, and was then poisoned a second time, either by gruel, excuse me, or needed food to revive him. So it was one of the stories that he got so sick that he vomited up the poison. I hadn't gotten no assistance yet, so they were waiting for him. So they had some gruel poison, and he better eat this for his stomach, and they gave him some more. Anyway, Tacitus also talks about it, and indicates that this was the only accepted view that he was going to be in a poisoning because he was going to change his will. Agrippina used the services of the famous poisoner Locusta, L-O-C-U-S-T, in case you're interested. She was a woman who was a famous poisoner. Famous. And Agrippina used her services. So much for Claudius. Very interesting character. Came to the throne, didn't want to be, had to hide behind a curtain, going out and remember, surprised everyone by being a good administrator, but just married the wrong women.
Now, when they call you a closet in?
Sorry?
When somebody says, they're all closet in.
Would you sit here and sit next to me? Any questions?
Yes. What was the son's name that he was going to send him to?
Britannicus.
Nero, the one that said it must have been food of the gods, that's what.
Yeah. Nero, joking about it later, said that mushrooms were food of the gods. Yeah. That's probably Nathan and the king one.
He wouldn't have just happened to have a poisonous mushroom or something. There was a natural attempt.
Oh, they were poisoned. Well, we move on. So the next thing, the last one we're going to talk about is Nero.